This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. The 2017 Keystone Progress Summit was held at the Hilton in Harrisburg, PA from February 17th to the 19th. Thomas Frank, author of Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, as well as numerous other books, gave the keynote address on Saturday, February 18th. Thomas Frank is introduced by Pat Clark, the board chair of the Keystone Progress Education Fund. This audio was recorded by Sean Kitchen of Raging Chicken Press.
Great to have a success story. Great to be bookended by very literate folks, too. I'm proud to have not just some of the most active on the street, knocking on doors, bugging their neighbors and peers folks with us, but in these two authors and many of our other panelists, some of the best thinkers, frankly, that we have at our disposal. I'm pleased to introduce yet another one of them in our next speaker, Thomas Frank. I mentioned I'm from Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's known for many things, great things, often determining how things work in the future. One of the things that kind of freaks me out is the fact that I now on a regular basis see robot cars all over the streets of Pittsburgh, sometimes two and three at a time. So the future is coming. These things are driven by mere algorithms, backed up by a guy who sits behind the wheel just in case. And the fact that I'm a little freaked out about that, I don't know if that makes me a lefty or a right-wing nut, a liberal, progressive, conservative, but it's going to have a large impact on our world and jobs and truck drivers and people right now. And this is one of those things that we need people in our movement who benefit all of us by thinking about these things. And Thomas Frank's books have charted a course over the past several years through uncertain times and taken a look at the profound issues that we've faced over those times and into the future, starting with what's the matter with Kansas, which a lot of people know about, and I don't know that we still have the answer for that. Followed by the wrecking crew in 2008 about how conservatives rule, 2012's Pity the Billionaire, and 2016's Listen Liberal. It's like a roadmap. I'm very proud to have him here. I'm hoping that he's going to be coming soon to Pittsburgh and Philadelphia in partnership with our work. I'm actually really proud to say that I learned today that he's a fan of another author I know, my wife, Al Hoff, author of the book and the zine series, Thrift Score. So it's a profound pleasure to introduce Thomas Frank.
Thank you very much. Can I put my water here? Is that cool?
Okay. So that was a wonderful history lesson, kind of shocking, but we need to remember stuff like that. And now I want to do a slightly different history lesson, more recent stuff. Can y'all hear me, by the way? Is this working? No? Okay, is it? Oh, now, how about now? That's what it is. I can just hold this thing, okay? Anyhow, more recent history. Trump. Okay, right? Here we are. Let's talk Trump. Now, think about this, the Trump rebellion, if, you know, depending on how you count it, this is either the fifth or the sixth successful conservative uprising to happen in my lifetime, okay? Remember, let's go over them for just a second. The original sort of backlash in 1968 that culminated with the election of Nixon, remember the silent majority, all that stuff. The backlash of the late 70s, right, Prop 13, and then culminating in the election of Reagan. The backlash of the 1990s, which gave us the Gingrich Congress, the George W. Bush backlash, and then, of course, the Tea Party movement just a couple of years ago, which culminated in Trump. And each one of these movements, each one of them, you know, all a puff with this kind of populist bluster, each one of them standing slightly rightward of the one that came before, and each one of them helping to compose another chapter in this sort of historical epic that I call the Great Backlash, that other people call the age of Reagan or the age of greed or the conservative ascendancy. At any rate, this is the story of our times. This is what it looks like. And it is amazing to me the way it just keeps chugging along. Think about it for a second. What things looked like back in 2008 and 2009 after the financial crisis and the Great Recession had started, and it looked like they had discredited the conservative philosophy for good, right? All this deregulation and look what happens, right? And you have the George W. Bush presidency ending in this crescendo of disaster. The Iraq War, Hurricane Katrina, the Jack Abramoff scandal, and then finally the economic collapse in 2008. And when that happened, the citizens of Beltway Consensus Land, which is where I live today, Washington, D.C., all of these fine, you know, right-thinking people agreed on the direction in which history was going. They had seen this movie before, and they knew how it was supposed to go. The tectonic plates of history were shifting. Conservatism's decades-long reign was finally supposed to be at an end. An era of liberal activism was at hand, they said. And this was supposed to be the unambiguous mandate of history, as unmistakable as the gigantic crowds that used to gather to hear Barack Obama speak as he traveled the campaign trail. You remember those days? And for the Republican Party, the pundits thought they knew what was supposed to happen. The Republicans had to moderate themselves or else face a long period of irrelevance. This is back in 08 and 09. And as the GOP failed to take the prescribed measures, the wise men prepared to usher them off the stage. If you go back and look at sort of newspaper commentary in 2009, Republican self-destruction was a favorite image. When former Vice President Dick Cheney announced that he preferred the hard line to the way of moderation, a New York Times columnist laughed that Cheney was on a political suicide mission. And if his own party is collateral damage, so be it. This is in 2009, remember. A respected political forecaster declared also in that same year that the chance of Republicans winning control of either chamber in the 2010 midterm elections is zero. Not close to zero, not slight or small, zero. So what the people in Washington expected from the leaders of the right wing was penitence back in those days. We assumed that conservatives would be humbled by the disasters that they had brought upon the nation, that Republicans would confess their errors and make haste for the center, right? A polite, white-collar America expected contrition from these guys. And you know what we got? Exactly the opposite, delivered on the point of a bayonet. Instead of complying with the new speed limit, the leaders of the right stepped on the gas. Instead of seeking accommodation, they went on a quest for ideological purity. And instead of elevating their remaining centrists to positions of power, they purged those guys. And in 2010, this radicalized Republican Party scored its greatest victory in congressional elections in many decades. They took 600 seats that year from Democrats in state-level elections. They purged countless Republican moderates from the Senate and the House. And in 2014, they completed their reconquest of Congress. And today, the tragedy is complete, folks. We are looking at a historic wipeout for the Democratic Party, who just a few years ago were so sure of themselves, who thought that they had all future presidential elections in the bag. What the hell went wrong? All right. To try to understand this, let's start with the long recession, okay? The recession that for a lot of people still has not ended to this day. And think about what it was like when it started back in 08 and 09. And a lot of liberals, like myself, thought we knew how this scenario was going to unfold, right? It was supposed to be mechanical. almost. Markets disintegrate, layoffs mount, foreclosures begin, and before you know it, the people are out in the streets and they are screaming for blood. And we know what's going to happen. The idols of our past will become objects of our derision, and we will demand that the government do something about it, that they punish the perps and they rescue the victims. And we look for insurance against further catastrophe and stricter supervision of the economy to make sure this never happens again. And that's what people like me expected to happen, and that's what we thought what was going to happen, because that's what happened last time around in the 1930s. This time, though, didn't work out that way. It was Tea Party conservatives who won the game. And they did it, and this is where the story gets weird, they did it by learning the lessons of the Great Depression, not by, like, mimicking what Franklin Roosevelt actually did, but mimicking the way he talked. During times of economic collapse, these guys figured out, nobody loves a defender of orthodoxy or some, you know, self-appointed champion of society's rightful rulers. And so when the collapse came along in 08 and 09, the conservative movement, and remember, these guys are very canny players. They play the game very well. But they immediately positioned themselves as a protest movement for hard times, as a social uprising with all of these sort of standard signifiers, right? They're out there in the parks waving placards. They're protesting banks and big corporations, or at least it seems like they are. They're yelling through bullhorns. They're organizing boycotts. There were marches on Washington and big talk about strikes of the producer class, you know, the Ayn Rand thing. Glenn Beck mimicked Martin Luther King's March on Washington. Rush Limbaugh had a favorite book at the time that railed against what he called the ruling class. Paul Ryan, who is today Speaker of the House of Representatives, wrote an article that he called Down with Big Business. He really did that. In which that's the headline, right? But if you look at the argument, what he's saying is that the struggle for a purified free market system is actually a revolt against big business as well as big government. And now here we got Trump. Here he comes. I was at the Republican convention last summer, and they called him America's blue-collar billionaire. And he pledged himself at the convention. He pledged himself to working class voters left behind by the current recovery. This is what he said. I have visited the laid off factory workers, the communities crushed by our horrible, unfair trade deals. This is an exact echo of Franklin Roosevelt. These are the forgotten men and women of our country, he said. People who work hard but no longer have a voice. This is extraordinary. This is a Republican saying this. He went on. It wasn't conservatives, in fact, who were the pawns of big money, Trump declared. It was Democrats. Big business, elite media, and major donors are lining up behind the campaign of my opponent because they know she will keep our rigged system in place, Trump said. They are throwing money at her because they have total control over every single thing she does. She is their puppet, and they pull the strings. The dude talks like Huey Long. Now look, there can be no doubt now, after he's been in office a couple of weeks, that this man is a hypocrite, in addition to being a vulgarian and a bigot, right? There's no doubt. But he connected emotionally. And he did it by talking the way Democrats used to talk, okay? Now look, I've written many books about the conservative movement. I spent a big part of my life criticizing conservatism, and it has been a lot of fun. Right? It is a blast poking holes in the things these guys say. I mean, they blow off the facts when they feel like it. They make up alternative ones. They swipe symbolism from the other side. They illustrate arguments on economics with fairy tales. They really do. I mean, these people will say anything. You know, the reasoning you hear, if you listen to their radio shows, the reasoning you hear sounds like a, you know, brainwashing session at Lubyanka prison or something like this, right? I mean, it is preposterous stuff. It is contemptible. But do you know what it's better than? Folks, it is better than nothing. Okay? I want to go back one more time to the details of those economic disasters that still to this day poison our every political moment, the financial crisis and the bailouts. And I want to remind you specifically that the culprits in these cataclysms, by which I mean the bankers who wrecked the economy of the entire world, that these people were not punished for what they did. They were rewarded. And when I say this, you know what I mean when I say this. They didn't get away with a slap on the wrist. They were laden down with billions and our blessings. And today these people are rich in a way that you and I will never be able to understand. Okay? And all of this happened, remember, all of this happened courtesy of the Obama administration, the officials of which then conducted themselves as though nothing really unusual had happened at all, right? The bailout money was recouped, they would say. The experts understand these things. Nothing to worry about here, nothing to see. Folks, listen to me. You could not have contrived a scenario better calculated to destroy public faith in American institutions. I mean, what is the point of hard work, of scrapping for a few dollars more at some lousy hourly wage when dishonest financial trickery is so profitable? Why? Seriously. Why play by the rules when they obviously don't apply to everyone? When louts and bullies and crooks take home our society's greatest rewards. Listen, the bailouts created a perfect situation for populism in the old Jacksonian tradition. For what we call, I'm from Kansas, for what we call out there, calamity howlers. For Jeremiah's raging against the corrupt and the powerful. And one of our two political parties, as I've shown, took to this task immediately and with relish, right? And they threw their old leaders overboard. They tossed these guys out. They declared war on what they called the ruling class and the rigged system. And they got out there in their park with their megaphones and gave voice to the people's outrage. Or it seemed like they did. Okay, but the important thing is that they were out there doing that. But the other party, the actual political descendants of Jackson and William Jennings Bryan and Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt, failed to rise to the occasion. They did not seem to understand that the circumstances called for something different this time. They could not embrace the requirements of the moment, even though responding to hard times was once their party's very reason for being. You remember when President Obama was elected in 2008 on this massive wave of hope and enthusiasm. And I was part of that, and I was hopeful, and I was enthusiastic, and I thought that we were looking at that man. This was my generation's Franklin Roosevelt. And then on the question of what to do about Wall Street, for the first couple of years in office anyway, Obama proceeded to continue the policies of President Bush essentially unchanged. He and his Democrats refused to change course when every sign was telling them to turn, when it would have been good policy to turn, when it would have been overwhelmingly popular to turn, when the country fully expected them to turn. When I say the country, the Wall Street bankers themselves, when he came in, they thought they were going to get taken to the woodshed. Well, we'll talk about that later. And fourth of all, when it was fully within his power, at the beginning of his administration, fully within his power to take the country in a different direction. And instead, the new administration did everything they could to foam the runways for the banks. Y'all remember that phrase, foam the runways? That's what Tim Geithner described the bailouts as being. Think about the Bush administration bailouts that they failed to unwind or even to call into question. The bad regulators that Obama never fired. The cram down that he never pushed for. The recovery, you know, the receivership of the zombie banks that he never did. The FBI agents that never got shifted over to white-collar crime. The executives of the bailed-out banks that never got fired, that richly deserved it, right? The too-big-to-fail institutions that never got cut down. The top bankers that never got prosecuted for anything on the long, long, long list of apparent frauds. They're still there, folks. Now, Barack Obama, a great man in many ways, didn't play this greatest of all issues the way he did because the working class rose up to defend investment bankers. That's not why he did it. He didn't play it this way because forcing the Republicans to defend Wall Street would have been bad politics. And he didn't do it because the presidency lacks sufficient power. Everything I just described was totally within his authority at the beginning. He played this issue the way he did because that's how he wanted to play it. We have to get our minds around that. All right. Now, why? This is just pushing the question further back. Why? What's wrong with the Democrats? Okay. Because this problem doesn't begin with Barack Obama. This goes way, way, way back. Now, when I was young, we were talking about 1983. That was the year I graduated from high school. And in those days, the Democratic Party used to always be grappling over its identity. Do you remember this? Arguing over who they were and what they stood for. And it went on all through the 70s and all through the 80s and well up into the 1990s. And you had all these different factions within the Democratic Party fighting like cats and dogs. But there was one thing that they all agreed on. And that was that the Democrats had to turn away from the legacy of the New Deal with its fixation on working class people, its hatred of banks, and its dreams of a comprehensive welfare state. Okay, they disagreed on everything else, but they agreed that that had to be left in the past. The man who came to symbolize the change was, of course, another Democratic president, Bill Clinton, who brought a new kind of Democratic administration to Washington when he showed up in 1993. And if we want to understand what's gone wrong with the Democratic Party, this is the period that we have to scrutinize, that we have to look at. Okay, so Bill Clinton comes to D.C. And rather than pay homage to the politics of Franklin Roosevelt, as Democrats used to always do, right? They'd show up in Washington and they'd do some, you know, obeisance at the shrine of Franklin Roosevelt. And he didn't do that. Clinton instead did these incredible favors for Roosevelt's old enemies, for the banks, the radio networks, the power companies, the bosses, basically. He deregulated Wall Street not once, but many, many, many times over the course of his presidency. He ensured that derivative securities would be traded without supervision of any kind. He deregulated radio and telecoms, basically put an end to the federal welfare system. You know, it was an amazing act. Clinton had a strategy as a candidate, y'all probably remember this, where he would go out of his way, this is when he was running for the presidency, where he'd go out of his way to distance himself from some traditional Democratic constituency like labor or minorities, and in this way assure the public that he was his own man, and he didn't take orders from anyone. The classic example of this is when Clinton contrived to insult Jesse Jackson to his face while the cameras were rolling. This was called the Sister Soldier moment. And nobody remembers the details anymore, but the logic of it was that people like Jesse Jackson's followers had nowhere else to go. Do you remember this phrase? This is sort of the great phrase of the Clinton era. Those people have nowhere else to go. What are they going to do? Go out and vote for the Republicans? Yeah, no way. Clinton did the same thing then to organize labor once he got into office when he signed NAFTA. Okay, and NAFTA is incredibly important when you're trying to understand what just happened to Hillary Clinton. All right, when Clinton rammed NAFTA through Congress, remember it had been negotiated by the Republicans. This was a Republican deal, but the Democratic Congress wouldn't pass it. Okay, it took Bill Clinton to come in, and he had Rahm Emanuel at his side, and they set up a war room, and they drove a steamroller over Dick Gephardt and the rest of these guys. And when he did this, of course, organized labor fought like crazy, and he smashed them. And when he was doing this, he wasn't just insulting organized labor like he had done with Jesse Jackson. He wasn't just insulting these guys. He was conniving in their ruin. Okay? He was assisting in the destruction of their economic power. He was doing his part to undermine his own party's greatest traditional ally, to ensure that in any kind of conflict between labor and management that would come up in the future, management would always have the upper hand. Right, because when workers try to organize, when they file a grievance about something, anything, they can always just say, "Well, we're moving the plant to Mexico." They always have that atom bomb in their hip pocket from now on, thanks to Bill Clinton. They can always threaten that. Sometimes, as we know, they follow through on it, but they threaten it all the time. It comes up in every contract negotiation. You guys know this. So when Clinton got NAFTA done, he made the problems of working people materially worse. Now, this has come back to haunt the Clinton family in a huge way. But at the time, now this is the interesting point here. You go back and read the literature of, of Clinton's admirers, his friends and admirers, the people who thought he was a great president. And they thought NAFTA was his finest moment. This was a great time for Bill Clinton. This was a brave, they said, almost Churchillian act, right? He defied organized labor in favor of professional economists, right? And what were these guys going to do, right? Go to the Republicans? Ha, 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 ha. Anyhow, there's a book that came out in 1996, a very pro-Bill Clinton book, a book that loved him, admired him, by a journalist named Martin Walker. And here's what he said about Clinton. He acknowledged that Clinton had a few failings, but he said that these were, in the end, balanced and even outweighed by his part in finally sinking the untenable old consensus of the New Deal and the crafting of a new one. Okay, now let that sink in, folks. That's why they liked him, because he killed the New Deal. That's why they liked him. That's why they admired Bill Clinton. Okay, so we had what Bill Clinton called the New Democrats now. The Third Way, a new Democratic Party. Now, who are the heroes of this new party? Now, the same Democratic thinkers who kept advising the party to abandon organized labor in the New Deal had the answer. What Democrats had to embrace, they said, was the emerging post-industrial economy, and the people that Democrats needed to identify with were the winners in this new order, the highly educated professionals who populated our innovative knowledge industries. And by professionals, I mean, you know, the traditional professions, lawyers, doctors, university professors, preachers. But in the information era, you've got, you know, this category of worker is exploding. It's becoming bigger and bigger. You have math PhDs writing derivative securities on Wall Street. You have biochemists making prescription drugs. Huge numbers of these people. And this group, as a socioeconomic group back in the 1950s, was the most Republican group in America, okay? By the end of the 1990s, they were the most Democratic group in America. They completely changed sides. And that's who the Democrats are to this day, the party of the highly educated professional class. Now, they have other constituencies, as we know. Most of organized labor is still with them. Minorities are still with them. Young people still vote Democratic. But the professionals are the ones who sit in the front seat and have the steering wheel in their hands. They're the ones whose technocratic outlook always tends to prevail. The rest of us ride in back, but these guys are in charge. And it's their tastes and their manners that are celebrated by liberal newspapers. And it's always their particular way of regarding the world that's taken for granted by liberals as being objectively true. Okay? So what I'm saying is that professionals today dominate liberalism and dominate the Democratic Party in the same way that Ivy Leaguers dominated the Obama cabinet, or that, I guess, billionaires dominate the Trump cabinet. Anyhow, so Democrats, I know, out of the frying pan, right? But Democrats came up, had all of these flattering phrases for their favorite demographic, right? All of these terms of endearment that they came up with to describe these people. They called these high-achieving professionals the wired workers who would inherit the future. They're supposed to be you're from Pittsburgh, you know this one, a creative class, right? That naturally rebels against fakeness and conformity. They're supposed to be they're supposed to be a learning class that truly gets the power of education. They're an innovation class that just can't stop coming up with awesome new things, right? The innovation class. And of course, Democratic leaders themselves are always drawn from the ranks of this same group. I mean, it's no coincidence you look at the life story of Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. These people were defined, their lives were defined by the time that they spent at prestigious universities. You know, that's what, and very prestigious, like Bill Clinton, Rhodes Scholar, Barack Obama, Harvard Law Review. This is what defined them and made them, as formed them as individuals. You look at their cabinet choices. All of these successful, usually Ivy League professionals whose worth was established by their achievements in college and graduate school. Okay, so what do professionals believe in? What does this mean to have a party that answers to a specific, very high-achieving social class, which is what we got with the Democrats and the Republicans, but we'll talk about them later. So what is this? What is the ideology of this class? Well, professionals are supposed to be the heroes of history, right? The winners in this debased dialectic of creativity and innovation that I'm talking about. They're the winners. They are the class that are the winners in the new economy. They're also the number one constituency of the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party leaders themselves are always drawn from this group. And this is the shift, okay? What I'm describing here, the shift from the traditional working middle class to professionals. This is what explains what is, you know, so much of what is frustrating about our modern day Democrats. This is what explains the problem that I was talking about before, the problem of Obama and the banks. Why did Team Obama fail to do what obviously needed to be done? Why did they declare that Wall Street executives were going to be held to a different legal standard than ordinary criminals? And they really did that. The guy who said it had to resign immediately, but he said it, right? Why did this administration choose Wall Street over average people again and again and again and again? Every time there was a choice to be made, they went in the direction of Wall Street. Why? Because for the achievement-conscious people who filled the Obama administration, investment bankers were more than friends. Folks, these people were classmates, and I mean that in more ways than one. These people were they themselves. There is no difference. The two groups are the same. They go back and forth through the revolving door. The guys at the Treasury Department look at Wall Street and they see people with subtle minds and sophisticated jargon. And, you know, they love that jargon, right? This extraordinary innovativeness, right? Financial innovation. It's such a beautiful thing. These are exactly the sort of creative individuals that Democratic Party theory tells us we have to honor and respect. They're making these financial instruments that are so admirably complex, right? It's like financial rocket science, as one member of the administration said. And by the way, he said that as an excuse for why they couldn't crack down on these guys. No one understands, man, complexity. And it's exactly the same for Big Pharma. So innovative. You can't import generic pharmaceuticals. You can't write a trade deal that'll import generic pharmaceuticals from Canada or India. You can't do that. You have to protect these innovative companies. And folks, mega dittos for Silicon Valley, right? An industry that can do no wrong in Democratic eyes. So lovable, Mark Zuckerberg. So professional. So creative that for this one industry, enforcement of our country's antitrust laws was basically suspended. For this one industry. So what does a party of the professional class believe in? Well, you know the number one item, of course, meritocracy. The conviction that the successful deserve their rewards and that the people on top are up there because they are the best. And this is the first commandment of the professional class. Everyone gets what they deserve, and what they deserve is defined by how they did in school. Okay? If you want, you know, you come to the Democrats looking for a solution to inequality, they'll tell you what the answer is. You got to go to a really top-notch college. That's the answer to inequality. What I'm describing is a philosophy of winners. And the Democratic Party today is a party of winners. And that is, folks, that is the left party in our system, in this country, a party of winners. There's a reason that when Barack Obama was in his last few weeks as president, published the articles, Washington Post called these the closing arguments of his administration. He published them in a series of academic magazines, Harvard Law Review, a couple others. I mean, there's a reason that Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign was all about reaching out to suburban Republicans and that she did so extraordinarily well in wealthy college towns. As for the working people that the Democratic Party used to care about, the party's leaders figure today, well, they have nowhere else to go in the famous expression of the Clinton era. The party just doesn't need to listen to them any longer. Well, folks, this is what happened this year. They found somewhere else to go. And that's the story of what just happened. And it's not a very reassuring story, and I apologize for that. But let's look forward a little bit. And I often, you know, the Republicans control both houses of Congress, the presidency. Trump just got to name a Supreme Court justice. I still can't believe that that stratagem worked, you know, not having any hearings on Obama's Supreme Court judge. That worked. And he just got to name his own. And they have, you know, how many state legislatures? I mean, these people can pass, they can amend the Constitution if they try real hard. And I often wonder these days, looking at this landscape of ruin, what things are going to look like after this new revitalized right does what they want to do over the next couple of years. Okay? Maybe they will finally push the country too far, and the conservative drift of the last 50 years will finally stop all on its own, and the nation will reverse course. Like the pundits have been saying off and on ever since the 1980s, they've finally gone too far. It's going to swing back the other way. Or maybe, as our country clambers further down into the sulfurous pit called utopia, the thinking of our free market friends will continue to evolve. And before long, they will have discovered that certain once non-controversial arms of the state must be amputated immediately. What are interstate highways and national parks, they'll ask, but wasteful subsidies for leeches who ought to be paying their own way? What is disaster relief but a power grab by losers who can't get themselves out of the path of a hurricane? You know that Social Security will go on the chopping block, of course, as the essential injustice of protecting the weak dawns on them. I mean, why should society pay for the retirement of someone who hasn't been all responsible and collected Krugerrands like everyone knows you're supposed to do? Every problem that you and I worry about is going to get worse, of course. Inequality, global warming, financial bubbles. But it won't matter. On America will go, chasing the only ideology that the country has left, down into the seething Arcadia of all against all. Thank you very much.